Hello. On this week's program, we celebrate Benjamin Franklin's 300th birthday. We'll talk about what's happening this week and listen back to recent features from the Culture File section at gophila.com. Franklin's work in the community led to what we today know as the Library Company of Philadelphia and Fireman's Hall. In this show, we'll also visit the Franklin Institute and Christchurch Burial Ground, Franklin's last resting place in Philadelphia. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
There's never been a question about whether Philadelphians like parties, especially when it's a family birthday party for our favorite founding father. Since last December, Philadelphia has gone giddy with Franklin-inspired fun and an outpouring of brotherly or maybe even great-great-grandchildrenly love for this community patriarch who exerted such an enormous influence on the city and its culture. Everyone has some sort of bent spin, some claim to the inheritance. This week and in upcoming months, you'll find restaurants serving Franklin fare, museums exhibiting Franklin artifacts, and musicians playing Franklin-era music. As but one example, tomorrow at 3 p.m. at the Curtis Institute of Music, you can catch an harmonica recital by Cecilia Gnaiwek and Curtis students playing songs about Franklin on the musical instrument he invented in 1761. It feels as if the man is even now amongst us, about to wander around the corner and join us for tea. For someone 300 years old, his historic accomplishments are impressive, his contemporary influence remarkable. New Franklin-inspired art commissioned from New York artist Brian Toll is on exhibit at the Institute of Contemporary Art until March 26. Josh Kornbluth's Ben Franklin Unplugged is being performed at Plays and Players Theatre through January 22nd. And new music by Daniel Kellogg, commissioned and performed in November by the Philadelphia Orchestra, will be performed again in excerpts on February 4th and March 18th. The centerpiece of all the Ben festivities is the international traveling exhibit at the National Constitution Center, Benjamin Franklin in Search of a Better World. The show will be in Philadelphia until April before moving on to four major museums around the US and then to Paris in 2008 for its grand finale. On Tuesday, his actual birth date, the official party at the National Constitution Center will start at 10 a.m. with the lighting of a birthday cake. At 11, there'll be a parade from the American Philosophical Society to Christchurch Burial Ground. But in truth, Philadelphia doesn't need a special party to celebrate Benjamin Franklin. He and his creations are all around us, part of our daily, year-round routines. Today's four features from the Culture File section at gophila.com are just a glimpse into Ben's world. We start with the Library Company of Philadelphia. Book clubs come in many shapes and forms, from Oprah Winfrey's one on television to smaller groups gathered in living rooms. This is not a new concept. In fact, even Ben Franklin was in a book club of sorts. When he was 25 years old, Franklin and 12 of his friends created a club called Junto, which is Spanish for group. The goal of Junto was mutual improvement. And one way these young men, most of whom had received little formal education, saw this personal improvement happening was by reading books.
They would meet every Friday night and talk about books a lot of the time. But since they didn't have any books and there weren't any bookstores in Philadelphia, they ran out of books to talk about pretty fast.
Jim Green is the current librarian at the Library Company of Philadelphia. The story of Junto is dear to him because it was from these humble beginnings that this 275-year-old institution sprang.
They each pooled their own little collections of books. They each had maybe owned one or two books, and they put them together and made them into a library that they could all use together. But the problem, of course, was that people took the books home and didn't bring them back, and that was not the first time that happened.
There were some institutions called public libraries in New England at the time, but none lasted for more than a couple of years because the books would disappear one by one. Ben Franklin was determined to figure out a system that would make a public library work.
What he came up with was a scheme that is called subscription. A subscription library is a library where shareholders, members, put a certain amount of money into the library and then a certain amount more each year. And then with that money, the library would buy books, and then anyone who was a shareholder could borrow the books.
By giving the shareholders a stake in the library, Green says Franklin discovered a way to ensure the books would be returned.
In fact, they might have forfeited their share if they didn't return the book. And since they had money invested, in a sense, then not returning a book would be a very stupid thing to do. This was a typical Franklinian way of getting people to do things. He would make it so that it was in your interest to do it my way. And it certainly worked here.
Franklin and his friends were able to expand the library company's membership and with that build the collection. With no bookstores in Philadelphia and few printing houses in the colonies, books were very expensive and difficult to come by. Wendy Wollison is the curator of printed books for the library company. Surrounded by stacks of books, she says Franklin and his friends were ever eager for new reading material.
They set up this system by which they communicated with book dealers in the major European cities and basically said, send us a trunk of books. Fill up a trunk with whatever's being published and ship it over.
The books were about medicine and politics, cooking and agriculture. They were useful books, and for many Philadelphians, the best way to learn how to build a street and a government. During the Constitutional Convention, the delegates were given passes to the library company to do research, and while Philadelphia was the country's capital, the library company was the nation's library. Philadelphia has changed, as has the public's access to books. But until fairly recently, the library company's collection, some of which can be traced back to Franklin, could still be borrowed.
Since the 1950s, we've become a non-circulating library, which is kind of amazing to think that up until the 50s, all of our rare books could leave the building. Now, we are a research library, so people come in and use our collections, but books don't go out.
And on any given day, the long tables of the library company are occupied with people poring over texts. The library is used by both scholars and the curious. Librarian Jim Green says there's something about almost every subject pertaining to early American history in these stacks.
It's the only colonial American library that survives intact. So this is a place where people come to find out what people were really reading, not some 20th century or 21st century reimagining or reconstruction of what people were reading, but the actual books.
The library company's longevity is also testimony to Benjamin Franklin's plan. After all these years, the books are still where he wanted them, in a place for people to learn. So why join a television book club when here in Philadelphia you can take part in what is perhaps the longest-running book club of all, Benjamin Franklin's?
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Franklin, the lover of books and learning, was also a man of action who became well known for extinguishing political fires in France. Back home, he put out real flames, but not by wielding buckets. In 1736, in Franklin's typical civic-minded style, he founded the first volunteer fire company so that neighborhood bucket brigades could better protect his beloved Philadelphia. Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis visits Fireman's Hall in the old headquarters of Engine No. 8, which preserves and continues this part of Franklin's legacy.
Of all the images that pop into your head when you hear the name Benjamin Franklin, a guy wearing a fire hat is probably not the most prominent. But at least one artist, Charles Washington Smith, portrayed him that way in 1850. And if you head down a cobbled alley off 2nd Street to Fireman's Hall, you can see the portrait along with historic engines, buckets, axes, hats, and other artifacts that show and tell the story of American firefighting. At first thought, the subject of firefighting can seem both simple and utterly unfathomable. People have been throwing water on flames since the first fire flared out of control. But how many of us really understand what it means to have a job where braving burning buildings is just another day at the office? A visit to Fireman's Hall allows us to step behind the scenes of this real-life adventure. But as Franklin was aware, and as Fireman's Hall makes clear, firefighting is more than water and courage, although you do need plenty of both. The museum is housed in a fire station, formerly the home of Engine Company No. 8, and staffed by real firefighters. Visitors can wander through the two-story firehouse, where exhibits interweave tales of firefighting function, ceremony, and culture. Firefighter Henry McGee, the curator of Fireman's Hall, says it was rough battling blazes in Franklin's day.
If you figure that you're doing everything with almost four-wheel push carts, almost like a bathtub, with really no directional mechanism with hoses or anything like that. The water was provided by bucket brigade. Everybody had to own buckets. Somebody had to ring the bell and warn the people that there was a fire. So I'm sure it was very hectic. Organization's the key. That's where he steps up to the plate and takes care of things.
The early buckets were made of leather. The first engines were wooden carts from which water had to be pumped by hand. The hall has several examples, the earliest, a 1730 Richard Newsom sidestroke engine. McGee explains how the hand pumpers worked.
Depending on the size of the hand engine, and depending on how many men could be on the sides to help stroke it up and down, and also the availability of water coming in from the river, as long as the pumper was kept full, and as long as the men were able to pump back and forth, they were able to keep the stream going into the building.
Through the years, firefighting continued to adapt as the city grew both up and out. Engines got bigger, ladders longer, and hoses more sophisticated. The bigger the engine, the more muscle was needed to operate it. Firefighter McGee says the large double-deck end pumper needed 40 men, 20 at a time, working two-minute shifts. In the 1850s, the steam engine came along. As railroads reached into the countryside, steam engines transformed the business of fighting fires in the city, as McGee describes.
Steamers were wonderful engines. They had a fire in them, of course, and as long as you kept coal burning and had a sufficient water supply, they would pump all day long.
Fire trucks are either engines, which carry water to extinguish fire, or ladder trucks, which rescue people. The front of a fire station is called the apparatus room. Here in the apparatus room of Fireman's Hall, we can walk among an assortment of black and red engines and ladder trucks, including an 1896 hand-cranked ladder truck with a tiller on the end, a 1907 horse-drawn coal-fired steam engine, and a 1926 motorized, still-functioning America LaFrance engine, complete with bell and siren. On the wall is an early telephone, which was used occasionally by neighbors from Alfred's Alley. Also, there is an alarm box and what was called the Gamewell Joker system, which from 1857 to as late as the early 1970s received signals about fires called in from street box alarms. The Joker box, although there's nothing really funny about its function, punches out numbers on a ticker tape that identify the box and street location of each blaze, as firefighter Manuel Gonzalez explains to a visitor.
Every fire station had this, so they know what when it was their turn to go.
7355. 7355. That's the box for here. Yeah, the box. It rings the amount of numbers on the box. This steam engine was pulled by three horses, and they knew when it was their turn by that noise right there. They knew when it was time to go. They were ready to go.
Above us, a man clings to a fire pole that stretches from the first floor to the second, although the holes in the ceiling are now boarded up, and the man is, well, a mannequin. Turns out fire poles, however cool they seem, are not the best way to get from one floor to another, and today's firefighters, like Leon Phipps, use the stairs.
Yeah, there's very few firehouses that have poles now. Very few. And I've been here 24 years, and I've never slid down a pole. Guys were breaking their ankles, so they more or less phased them out.
On the second floor, we see a section of an old wooden water main, the kind first laid in 1799. We walk through a replica of a cabin of a fireboat and look at photos, badges, hats, horns, and other memorabilia, as well as an old net that looks sort of like a trampoline. Nets, says Fireman Phipps, have gone the way of fire poles, retired from active duty as too treacherous.
The nets took about 14 people to hold. And ladder companies carried the nets, and there's just not enough guys to hold them. It was dangerous for the people that were jumping and the people that were holding it. If too few guys are holding it and somebody jumps in it, either you're going to drop it and they're still going to get hurt or you're going to break your arms.
Reminding us of just how perilous this job is a stained glass memorial under which are inscribed the names of Philadelphia firefighters killed in action from 1791 to the present. Sobering reminders, perhaps, of Franklin's wisdom when he wrote, "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure," urging that the best way to fight fire is to prevent it. Fireman's Hall continues Ben Franklin's tradition of raising public awareness of fire safety. Of all of Benjamin Franklin's contributions, there are few that so practically enrich and even save lives. Think about that the next time you pull over to allow a glistening, squealing red truck to pass as it continues Franklin's inextinguishable legacy.
Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis. And as with all of the features you hear in today's program, you can get more information at the Culture File section of gophila.com. The cooking stove you can see at Fireman's Hall was one of Franklin's many inventions, products of his insatiably curious mind. This passion for scientific discovery lives on today at the Science Museum, which bears his name. And for many people who grew up visiting the Franklin Institute, The giant model of a human heart is truly the heart of the museum. Weighing 4 tons, this walk-through heart is large enough to bring a woman the size of the Statue of Liberty to life. The line moves slowly as the kids crowd to walk through the valves of the pink replica, dragging their small hands along the smooth walls. One of the most popular science museums in the country, the Franklin Institute prides itself as an innovator in exhibits and education. Like the rest of the city, it's celebrating the legacy of its namesake, Benjamin Franklin. Franklin himself never stepped inside the Franklin Institute. It wasn't established until 1824, 34 years after his death, and even then it was something quite different. Philip Hammer is the vice president of the Franklin Center at the Franklin Institute. He explains the origins of the institution.
That part of the 1800s was during the height of the Industrial Revolution. Philadelphia was sort of the Silicon Valley of the U.S. in its day. And the Franklin Institute was founded as a school to train people in what they called the industrial or mechanical arts, basically how to design and build things. They would have been today's engineers and computer scientists.
So the Franklin Institute was founded as an institute, a school. Interesting, considering Franklin himself stopped attending school in the fourth grade, although he did once say, "Genius without education is like silver in the mine." But as Philip Hammer points out, what he lacked in education, he made up for in motivation.
Besides being known for his printing and communication skills, he was a great inventor. He sort of planted the seeds for Philadelphia being this center of innovation. He died in 1790, and so 35 years later, people wanted to form this school in his honor to carry on his tradition, to continue to make Philadelphia the center of intellectual and industrial activity.
New York soon took over as the country's capital of commerce and industry, and as more universities sprung up, there was a diminishing need for this kind of learning institution. But with all its collections and knowledge, the Franklin Institute, in the spirit of its namesake, created another purpose for itself.
We had acquired all these models of invention, and we began to put them on display. That's how the cabinets of curiosity got filled. And so we realized back then that, you know, even though the school might not have been as viable anymore, we still had all this great stuff that people could come in and see. So that's sort of how we gradually made this transition from a school to more of a museum.
The collection eventually outgrew its Center City location, which now houses the Atwater Kent Museum, and moved to its current location on, where else, the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. Built in the 1930s, even though it was in the midst of the Great Depression, the idea of the grand building for this cherished city institution was so popular that $5.1 million was raised for its construction in just 12 days. The building was opened to the public in 1934. Now, over 70 years later and 300 years after Franklin's birth, the museum is still very much about Franklin. In fact, each visitor is greeted in the Great Hall by his grandfatherly likeness.
When people come into the building, they walk up the big steps. The first thing they see is this huge white marble statue of Benjamin Franklin, which is now the nation's memorial to Franklin. So when people visit the Franklin Institute, they can't escape the fact that this place is all about honoring his memory and carrying his legacy forward, which is really all about curiosity and exploration.
In addition to a room dedicated to aviation, a planetarium, and even a hall dedicated to the science of sports, there's a section showcasing Franklin's contributions to society and science. There are displays explaining electricity and his various inventions, from the still useful bifocals to some of his less plauded innovations.
We just learned that he made the long-reach arm, and I never knew that. It's right over there. He used it to grab books in his library.
Sue and Natasha are two young women on a Franklin expedition from Brooklyn. Stylishly dressed, they look like they would be more interested in a contemporary fashion designer than a long-deceased statesman. They explain some of their attraction to the great historical figure.
I like that he did so many different things and that he was such a curious person.
Founder of electricity, founder of the long-reach arm.
Politician, ambassador.
Enjoying the fresh air baths. Apparently downtown, he used to like to sit outside naked and call it his fresh air bath.
In the lobby outside the Franklin exhibit, a group of children gather around a table. Shawanda Spivey is an educator at the museum. She's holding a sheep's heart and a dissecting tool. Even the children, who look a little squeamish, can't keep their eyes off it. They make fists with their small hands to understand just how big their own heart is. And whether it's 4 tons or much smaller, Franklin himself would probably admit that this museum's got a lot of heart. More information on the Franklin Institute is available at the Culture File section of gophila.com. For those of us who still can't decide what we want to be when we grow up, Benjamin Franklin is a formidable source of both inspiration and intimidation. Printer, journalist, scientist, diplomat, founder of the first, well, the first of just about anything you'd want in a community. Hospital, volunteer fire company, insurance company, university, library, even a militia. And on top of this, he could make people laugh. He was, some might argue, the ultimate founding father. Founding a nation and fathering a way of life, thinking up so many things we take for granted. Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis says it's no wonder so many people come to throw pennies on his grave, tucked inauspiciously along the edge of Christchurch Burial Ground on Arch and Fifth Streets.
Just a few steps from buses spilling out tourists for the Constitution Center, the Liberty Bell, or Independence Hall, a quiet 2-acre patch of ground lies hidden behind a brick wall, but for an opening onto Arch Street's sidewalk and a section of iron bar fencing through which you can see the horizontal flat gray marble slab marking Benjamin Franklin's grave. This is Christchurch Burial Ground, a tree-shaded, park-like setting. Modest, worn grave markers interspersed among larger headstones, box markers, and pedestals, all lined in rows on either side of a path running the length of the yard. Despite its tranquil beauty, we are reminded that it is a burial ground, as distinct from a cemetery which might be deliberately landscaped to attract visitors. This was a field purchased in 1717 to supplement the parish graveyard surrounding Christ Church a few blocks east. In 1772, the brick wall was built around it, presumably to keep grazing livestock from wandering onto the graves. Today we can experience it simply as a peaceful oasis amidst the hustle-bustle of Philadelphia's historic district. Or we can dig beneath the surface, in a manner of speaking, and learn the stories behind the stones. Benjamin Franklin is here in his family's plot. Raised a Puritan, he nevertheless rented a pew in Anglican Christ Church, which church historian Neil Ronk suspects might have had motives beyond the spiritual.
Christ Church was a very good church for a young man with aspirations in life, like Mr. Franklin did as a young man. It was the great non-Quaker yuppie church of 18th century Philadelphia.
Franklin used lotteries to raise money to build the steeple that would make the church the tallest building in America for 75 years and a great source of civic pride. Another consideration may have sparked, if you will, his interest in getting the steeple built, says Ronk, since the tall structure could come in handy for his electricity experiments. Benjamin Franklin died and was buried in 1790, and in a sense, it was his presence that would keep the burial ground alive for the public for the next 200 years. In 1858, at the request of Franklin's descendants, a section of the brick wall was replaced with iron fencing to allow public viewing of his grave. A few years later, church warden Edward Clark did a survey, and a map of the grounds was made. Franklin is only one of over 4,000 people interred here, most of whom were buried in the 18th and 19th centuries. In 2003, the church opened the grounds, allowing the public to visit the other grave sites, including those of other signers of the Declaration of Independence, 10 mayors of Philadelphia, and people from many other walks of life. Some markers have survived the years, including the prominent stones for Dr. Benjamin Rush, father of American psychiatry and a signer, and Johan Heineken, a diplomat whose family later founded the Dutch Brewing Company. Other memorial stones were created for prominent people for whom there were records of burial but no identifiable markers, including Francis Hopkinson, another signer of the Declaration, as well as a lawyer, musician, composer, and an artist who contributed to the design of the American flag, and David Salisbury Franks, a diplomat and the highest-ranking Jewish officer in the Continental Army. The burial of Major Franks at the request of a parishioner remains a bit of a mystery, but one that the church as caretaker affords great respect, says Ronk.
We finally said the Kaddish at where we believe he is buried, but we said it last October, 211 years after he died. So why he was buried at our burial ground, we don't know.
The diversity in the burial ground mimics the society of the time, and tours have been fashioned along various themes, including specialized tours on the signers, the victims of yellow fever, military personnel, medical pioneers, and a new tour that focuses on Benjamin Franklin's family, friends, and foes. Despite the finality and the apparent stillness of the burial ground, there are still some things that can go bump in the night.
This area in the back part of the burial ground, it seems to be pushing up. As you can see, the stone over here actually pushed out of the ground, that large stone, and fell over.
As sexton and burial ground coordinator John Hopkins explains, over time the ground moves, making the process of discovery still very much alive.
You could see the mark where this was underground, and it was actually pushed out of the ground and revealed the name of this young girl, Frances Earle, who was buried here, who was, until last year, unidentified.
And new discoveries continue to arise. The church recently re-landscaped the area around Franklin's grave to accommodate increasingly large numbers of visitors to the site. The excavation and removal of bricks from a path that was laid in the 1950s revealed a grave marker for members of the Usher family, including Robert Usher and his brother Abraham, whom officials say would in all likelihood have known Franklin. Church historian Neil Ronk says that they had to run a fine line between historical and sacred considerations, and after consultation with a Fairmount Park Preservation Trust, the church decided to leave the marker in place and to landscape as planned, once again covering the stone. On the wall adjacent to his final resting place is the rather tongue-in-cheek epitaph Franklin wrote for himself when he was only 22. Likening himself to an old book whose cover might be gone but whose work would survive, if he only knew. Today, what's on his gravestone, in accordance with his later instructions, is a simple inscription of his name and that of his wife, Deborah. Pennies saved? Well, maybe not the way Franklin intended. But they are surely pennies Franklin has earned. And in this case, these earned pennies are saved in a fund to help maintain Christ Church Burial Ground, Franklin's final Philadelphia home.
Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis. And that's it for this Benjamin Franklin 300th birthday special. The program was written and produced by Teresa Madden, Susan Lewis, and myself, with thanks also this week to Paula Butler. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.